Wow.
What's up?
I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
Now, from Wichita's most listened to sports radio, 97.5 and 1240 KFH, this is Sports Daily with Jacob Albrecht and Tommy Kester.
Hey, welcome in, everybody. Happy Wednesday here on Sports Daily. It is Jacob Albrecht and Tommy Kester. We are excited to be with you. It's a game night for KU, for K-State. We'll have our KU insider, Shri Islada, in a little bit later to help us look ahead to the Jayhawks, maybe an early look at some bracketology in things like that. Major League Baseball has the newest members of the Hall of Fame inducted. We'll go through the winners there and did anybody get snubbed and some other things. It's a big Wednesday. Tommy, how are you?
Man, happy Wednesday. Good to see you today. We got a lot to get to. Of course, getting ready for the AFC Championship game on Sunday, Chiefs and Bills. I know that we talked a lot about it yesterday. As the week goes on, I know we'll get into it a whole lot more.
Yeah, we will. And we'll look at it, you know, sort of from the perspective of what went wrong the first time and what can the Chiefs correct this time. Andy Reid talked Monday, so we'll go through some of what he's saying, one of the big takeaways for the Chiefs, and what really was their worst defensive performance of the regular season, the game that they lost. If you throw in the trash can week 18, which we will, that's what that game was. So we'll get into that as well, all kinds of good stuff. We'll give away some HTO before the end of the show today, so stay tuned in for your opportunity to win some free iced tea, free coffee. Glad to be here. Speaking of coffee, thanks to Prairie Fire Coffee for keeping us fueled up here on KFH and all across our Odyssey stations. Tommy, in this first segment, we haven't talked about this at all. And in a quicker segment, might be a good time to do it. The downtown ballpark in Wichita is getting a new name, Equity Bank Ballpark, which is great. People can get annoyed with changing because Riverfront's a cool name. Let's be honest. Riverfront Stadium's a cool name. But Equity Bank Ballpark, to me, just getting naming rights to anything screams relevance, right? And for the city, who's going to get, you know, $115,000, $117,000 a year for the next 15 years for just kind of kicking back their feet and being able to sit there and take that revenue share as they're telling us we've got to pay for downtown parking and do all the things that we have to do and budget shortfalls and they're challenging and, you know, first responders and whether or not we can afford to hire them. Like, that's a nice thing too. So like if to me, it's like, yeah, Riverfront, that's a cool name. Equity Bank Ballpark, it's a local company. It's a bank that started in Wichita, which is kind of cool. And maybe two firefighters saved their jobs because the city has an extra $117,000. Yeah. So Equity Bank Ballpark it is. You know, it's a good thing, I think, to get that kind of stuff done. Intrust Bank Arena, right? Another local company. It adds that. It is what it is. Now, when they change a lot, that's where I think you can get a little dicey. Like, people complain about it, but it's like, guys, look across the NFL. There aren't very many Arrowheads. There are,
but
more.
Even Arrowhead is GEHA Field at Arrowhead
now
Stadium.
Now it is, right? Like, but I'm saying, like Heinz Field, yeah, right? Like, that's right. A sponsored place,
right?
AT&T Stadium, Jerry World, like, yeah, they coexist, these things. So, you know, it's part of the course, and to me, it again, it screams relevance, and that's a good thing.
It screams relevance. It also screams, you know, partnership and collaboration, and, you know, sure, local business wanting to, you know, support a downtown ballpark and have the naming rights and all of that. I mean, look, at the end of the day, like, these are for-profit institutions, right? And so, you know, yeah, being able to make money not only provides relevance, but it also provides sustainability, you know, and have that revenue coming in so we can have a viable minor league baseball team, you know, here in Wichita. And I remember, I know that you were here for the first couple of years when, you know, this was a thing, but we didn't have affiliated baseball for a long time in Wichita. You know, it was probably close to 15 years that we didn't have affiliated minor league baseball in town. And so if you want to keep it viable and sustainable and all of that, these are the sort of things that, you know, you want to see happen. And so shout out to the Wind Surge, shout out to Equity Bank for the new Equity Bank Park. That's awesome. I think what's also funny too is, you know, you hear from people usually on social media that are talking about selling out and I'm still going to call it Riverfront and blah. Okay, cool. Fine. Call it Riverfront. That's great if you want to. But I promise you that if somebody came to you and offered you money to slap logos all over your clothes as you were going around, you know, to your day to day, you'd probably do it. I know I certainly would. Most people probably would. And so this is a good thing. It's a positive thing. It shows forward momentum and development for the city. And I'm here for it, you know, entirely.
Well, just, I mean, no matter what you think, it raised funds for the city.
100%.
That's a good thing. Like that's, you know, from, you know, as taxpayers foot the bill for some of this stuff in a lot of ways, getting money back to the city is the goal.
It's a big deal.
That's the goal, economic development. So that happened. It's been sort of in the works. They just finalized the vote yesterday on the revenue share portion.
You know, by the way, you and I have talked a couple of different times on this show over the months and the last couple of years about, you know, the Wind Surge attempting to try to find ways to be, you know, more, you know, accessible for people in the community and things like that from a ticket price deal, from a pricing perspective and all of that, and different improvements and adjustments and changes that, you know, I think you and I both wanted to see to help make it more viable in this city. And I think that the Wind Surge has done that. There, you know, nobody's perfect and there are always going to be hurdles and roadblocks. But man, I think that, you know, it's definitely been a much improved franchise from the last couple of years to today, which is awesome.
Two years ago, that all changed.
It 100% did. And yeah, I'm not sure that you and I, you know, really fully believe that it would actually get to this point. At least I'm not sure I did. And it has. And again, nothing is ever perfect. There are always going to be things to be improved. But I think it's night and day better than what it was a couple of years ago, for sure.
It's been a windy road to get to the place we all thought it was going to be from the beginning. Some really unfortunate things happened. So the road took a weird turn, but then it's, you know, a couple of years ago, it started to come back and they're just that, you know, the improvements continue and yes, generating revenue for the city, especially is something, you know, that's good for everybody because it's money that doesn't come out of your pocket.
Right.
You know, that's the bottom line. The end of the day, if you don't care about baseball, great. That's money that doesn't come out of your pocket. So like to see that. That's the revenue shared portion.
We are 15 years. We just celebrated 15 years of Intrust Bank Arena here in Wichita. So 15 years into the downtown arena, and there's not a soul that I know of that complains about the fact that it's called Intrust Bank Arena, right? Like that's been
that's
that way.
That's what the name is, right?
It's been that way.
It didn't have a name before, though, did it? Did it have a name?
I mean,
before?
I think it was, I don't know, Downtown Wichita Arena. I'm not sure. Yeah. I mean, they got the naming rights, you know, right away.
Yeah. Grow into it.
You grow into it, and people will grow into Equity Bank Park. That's perfectly fine. No big deal there. And I think that, you know, now what we've been able to see with the arena, with, you know, organizations like Visit Wichita here in town, bringing in, you know, big time events like the figure skating championships going on this week downtown, NCAA tournament, the opening rounds in a couple of months. Like those are big name events here in Wichita that we wouldn't have without Intrust Bank Arena, you know, and without the support of organizations like Visit Wichita. So at the end of the day, this is growth, it's economic development, it's all of those things working together. And you know, it shows, to your point again, viability, sustainability, progress, growth, all of those things.
Yeah, and it's a name. So just call it what you want. It doesn't really matter. It
doesn't matter.
Equity thinks it's worth it, and that's all that does matter. And they, so the number, the 117 that you've read about, that's the city's portion of it. The deal's larger. The Wind Surge aren't going to disclose the total value of the deal. So it obviously has value for the Wind Surge too. You know, good for them and their endeavors. All right, we're going to come back. And we'll dig in. Chiefs round two with the Bills. College basketball talk. We got a lot to get to today on the program. Thanks for being here with us. It's all Brockton Caster. We're coming right back.
Dude, you got to hear this. Hear this.
Go ahead. I think I want to hear this.
Sports Daily is on KFH.
Welcome back, everybody. Something we haven't talked about. We told you that Crestview Country Club's a great sponsor of this program, and we're out there, and we appreciate it, and we have fun. They do big event stuff, too. Tommy and I haven't been in the market for a marriage in a while, but they do a lot of weddings out there. Never say never, Tommy.
Yeah, you never know. I mean, depends on the day of the week, I guess.
We're a little tough to put up with. So they do weddings. They do large events. I've thought about doing a fantasy football draft out there. They have a couple of different cool little rooms, some with like bars in them and stuff. But that's a part of it too. So another thing, just to give them a call, check out and the facility, do all that stuff. Tell them we sent you. We love it out there. It's almost, we're closer than we think to getting back out there, playing a little golf. That pool will be open before we know it, which is, I've told you before, the pool is what we use, our family, more than anything else. It's a great pool. But give them a call. Tell them we sent you. We appreciate their support here on Sports Daily. Baseball Hall of Fame, Tommy. Three very deserving, in my opinion, members in Ichiro, CC Sabathia, and Billy Wagner. Can't imagine a Hall of Fame without any of those three players. Ichiro, of course, is all but one vote because the writers have the integrity to protect if we can't have.
Do we know who that one person is? Who's that one vote? Do we know who that is?
I've got to protect the integrity.
No, we don't.
Like, can
don't
we take that vote away? I'd love to be able to find out who that
apparently,
is.
There's apparently a way that they can be. I don't know. I don't even. Honestly, I don't even care about it. Like, it's so silly. Like, it's so dumb. Whatever. I don't need to go down the road I was about to go down because that's not nice. It's silly that we do this. Like, how? Who doesn't think Ichiro's a Hall of Famer? Because the answer is nobody. And the reason he doesn't get it is because somebody wants to make sure he's not unanimous. If Ichiro's not a unanimous first ballot, like, who is then? The dude was like a senior citizen when he came over to the States and still had 3,000 hits. Like, can we get out of here with that? We've never seen anybody do what he does. Is he the best player ever? No, but he's one of the most unique players we've ever seen. Incredible baseball player. Like, get out of here with all that nonsense.
We're talking about a four-time MVP. We're talking about a dude that won 9 batting titles, All-Star, Gold Glove, 3,000 hits. Like, yeah, I mean, does he fit the profile of the big sluggers of his day? No. You know, he's not.
And he's as much of a steroid candidate as I am.
100%. Right? I mean,
we're
he doesn't
built about the same way.
He doesn't fit that profile. But, he came over, took the league by storm. You know, such a unique, you know, kind of way that he approached batting and his batting stance and the way, I mean, just the way that he played the game. I mean, come on, like. I agree with you. Like, if you're going to have a unanimous selection to the Hall of Fame, there's not a better candidate than Ichiro to be unanimous.
Let me be clear. I don't even think it makes sense that you think a player is a Hall of Famer one year and not another, right? Like, I don't care that there might be a big class of Hall of Famers. Like, you either think a player is a Hall of Famer or you don't. How do you change your mind on that? That's how stupid this is, right? If you want to say only the top 5 vote getters can get in, do it that way. But don't do it where you have to decide, like, this year, no. Not a Hall of Famer. Because guess what? They're retired. Nothing changed the next year when all of a sudden you think they're a Hall of Famer. It makes me so angry. I hate it. It's so stupid that they hold these players hostage like this. And it's a power trip, Tommy. That's all it is. It's a power trip by a bunch of baseball writers who want to pretend like it's 1934 and people care about their power.
Trivia question for you. Do you know who the only player is to be elected unanimously?
I didn't think we had one.
Yeah, there's one. There's one player that's been elected unanimously.
I'm going to guess it's a Dodger.
Okay.
Oh.
I mean, you can guess that it's a Dodger. That's the wrong guess.
Okay. Babe Ruth? I don't know.
No. Mariano Rivera is the only unanimous.
Did he get it in? Well, credit to them.
He did.
I just dogged on him. That's another perfect example of like, if that guy's not, then who is? So good for them for doing it. So if you can do it for Rivera, though, do it for Ichiro.
Yeah.
Like, Ichiro, let that be the end of this.
We know that Ichiro missed it by one vote as far as unanimous. That's tied for second with Derek Jeter, who also was not unanimous. Derek Jeter missed it by one vote. Yeah.
Yeah, Jeter's is the one I remember. And so whatever. It's like, you take the relevance. I don't care. I just care who's in the Hall of Fame. So we look at it and like those three certainly deserve it. I don't think there's much debate about that, quite frankly. It's when you go further down the list. And to me, so again, like for me, if you're a Hall of Famer, you're a Hall of Famer. Like, why did Billy Wagner need to wait 10 years? He his numbers didn't change in the last decade. What changed? So if you want to say you can only take up to five and it's the five top guys, great. But how does your vote change? Explain that to me, right? Like, it doesn't make any sense. So those three get in. The next closest is Carlos Beltran, who I would say is a Hall of Famer. Andrew Jones, who I would say is a Hall of Famer.
Absolutely is a Hall of Famer.
And then you get into all of the, there says the Braves fan. Then you get into all the steroid guys, Alex Rodriguez, Manny Ramirez, Andy Pettit. So there's a couple more to me that are no-brainers. Felix Hernandez, no-brainer. Dude's a Hall of Famer. There's a couple of Phillies who I think have really interesting cases in Chase Utley and Jimmy Rollins. I'd have to really think about that, but I think they could be. And then there's one further down the list of the guys actually getting votes that I would put in, Omar Vizquel. Because he did something better than ever. It's a little like Andrew Jones, honestly. Like, when a player is clearly the best defensive player for that long and still good enough offensively to be an all-star lots of times, I would put that player in. I like to remember that Vizquel was one of the great defensive players of probably two generations, quite frankly, and was able to find value and staying power in that in a lot of teams and all those things. So I'd put him in too. But that would be it for me. I mean, Carlos Beltran and Andrew Jones are for sure. I'd have to date. And Felix Hernandez. Like, Felix Hernandez. What are we doing?
Yeah,
Felix
Hernandez, I mean,
Hall of Famer?
Don't you think that Beltran is getting, quote-unquote, punished by the writers for his role in the Astros situation? I think that's probably part of it. I mean, remember, he was hired to be the Mets manager and then was fired before he was even able to manage a game because of the fallout from all of that. So I can see these baseball writers who love to clutch their pearls and, you know, they like to throw the rocks at the glass houses and all of that.
Well, I don't like the cheaters either, but it doesn't make him not Hall of Famer.
Right. And you know, the Astros fallout. Yeah, Beltran was a player then, right, when all that went down with the Astros, like at the very tail end of his career. I think that's right. Or maybe he had just transitioned into being a coach. Regardless, you know, it doesn't take away what he did over the course of his career, going all the way back to his days with the Royals. I mean, he was phenomenal coming up from the minor leagues and then going and, you know, playing for teams like the Mets and, you know, other teams. I mean, he was just a fantastic player all around. If we're judging Hall of Fame candidacy based on what you did on the field, and I know that there's so much debate about what constitutes a Hall of Famer, then regardless of what happened with the whole Astros situation, Beltran's stats alone stand out that should make him a surefire Hall of Famer.
Correct. But Felix Hernandez, I cannot believe, is not a first ballot Hall of Famer. Like, honestly, though, he was maybe the best for a very long time. Just played for the Mariners and they sucked. I would put, we've said this before, not to take the discussion down this road, I would also have the steroid guys in, get them off the ballot. Obviously, their numbers are there. And then you just fly. It's a museum. It's easy to say the story of their careers through whatever it is that you need to say. Just put it all on there, right? These guys were played in an era and had XYZ and let people make their own decisions. But what that, you know, that doesn't, I get that one a little bit more. What I don't get is these players that are held hostage, like Billy Wagner, for 10 damn years. Like, that is so stupid and ridiculous to make somebody who is in the top five at his position, we'll call it, all time, if not higher, maybe the top three all time, to not put them in a position that is clearly valued that way by everybody, by teams, by whoever you want to look at. That position is that way. I think we need to find a way to look at relievers in general a little bit more, find some tangible metric so that if, you know, if it's not the save, because you can't have a save if you play for a crap team, right? They have to win games. Yeah. It's kind of like Felix Hernandez. Like, what's the metric we can use for the all-time great relief pitchers? I'd like to find that, but Billy Wagner was certainly one of them. If we go way, way down the list, I'm looking like Cargo could have a case someday. Adam Jones was at the top of his game for a long time. Troy Tulowitzki, I think, is really interesting. My guy, Ian Kinsler, selfishly, I'd love him to get a look. Mark Burley, I think, could get in at some point. If you're taking Kinsler, you got to take Pedroia. If you're taking Utley, you got to kind of take Pedroia and Kinsler.
I mean, they just open it up to everybody. I mean, like, look.
Well, it's not opening it up to everybody. So here, let me give you my criteria. And I know that I'm a little more inclusive than most to the Baseball Hall of Fame because I think it's hard to compare generations in any sport. I sort of say it this way. Were you like the best at your position for a long period of time? And I'd have to really dig in to give you a stretch, whether it's like 7 years, 8 years, 10 years, whatever it is. Were you the best in the generation that you played? Were you definitively one of the best players of that generation? Because what I don't think you want to do with the Hall of Fame, and I think this happens too often, is leave a generation of fans out. And that's what you do. Like, if you don't take Billy Wagner, like that leaves a generation of fans, not just Astro fans, but real baseball fans, baseball lifers, baseball junkies. Like, if you leave him out, you're leaving out the best of a generation, right? And I think that's where you can miss with the Hall of Fame. I'm not saying all those guys I just mentioned, I'm not saying I would put them, I'd really have to dig in. But what I can say about those particular players is they were, for a long time, the best of their generation, right? Like Dustin Pedroia, who I personally think is really annoying, but he was one of, if not the best second baseman for a long time. So was Kinsler, so was Utley. That's why I think those guys have a really good case. I think you have to do it because maybe they don't match up to an era where the pitching wasn't as good, or players who are inflating the numbers that played in the steroid era, whether or not they were caught or not. You know what I mean? Like, it's too hard to stack up a generation to a generation. So just look at it generationally. Like, did you fit in? And during the time that you played, and we do need the benchmarks to some degree. But more than anything, I think we always should be celebrating the best players in baseball.
I look at it a little bit differently than you do, and I get your inclusiveness and all of that. I look at it more from the perspective of, is the Hall of Fame egregiously missing somebody? That's why I'm like, Carlos Beltran needs to be a Hall of Famer. Andrew Jones should be a Hall of Famer. But then I look at it and I'm like, is the Hall of Fame worse off because Ian Kinsler is not a Hall of Famer? No, probably not.
Like, not a no doubt.
Is it egregious that he's not in the Hall of Fame? No, it's not egregious. Same thing with Dustin Pedroia. Mark Burley, is the Hall of Fame missing out? If somebody's going to Cooperstown and walking around the museum and looking at all the busts and the players and everything, are they going to walk away and be like, man, that would have been a whole lot better had Mark Burley been in there? No, like, nobody is thinking that. But you can walk around and you can say, man, a dude that is one of only 8 players in Major League Baseball history to have 400 or more career saves, and he's not in the Hall of Fame, and it's taken 10 years to get him elected in Billy Wagner. Yeah, like, that's an egregious, blatant miss. And so that's the way that I look at it, more from just an overall. I'm not even looking at it generationally. I'm looking at it more from a fact of, like, when you're stacking up who's in and who's out, are there, like, glaring misses? And there absolutely is. I'm a big believer. I know you brought this up a minute ago. I'm a big believer in getting the steroid era players, especially the hitters, in the Hall of Fame, as long as you have caveats in their induction. And I don't know if it's an asterisk or whatever it is. As long as you have something in there acknowledging the era in which they played, as long as they are in. Because if you're looking at it just strictly from a benchmark perspective, yeah, it's an egregious, blatant miss that guys like Alex Rodriguez is not in the Hall of Fame.
So it is. And you just want to remember them. And so let me take it this way, too. When a guy like Kinsler, for example, and again, like, full disclosure, huge Kinsler fan, Like he was, I loved watching him play. I'm a Rangers fan, but I'm just going to use him as an example because I'm a little more familiar, like with his numbers. So you go and look, and he was one hit shy of 2,000, which may have made a huge difference, which is too bad. But he had his hits. He's 14th on the all-time second base, you know, hits list. But he, Tommy, played in 400 fewer games than a guy like Roberto Alomar. If you go to the power numbers for a second baseman, he's top. He's seven. He's top 15 in hits, top 15 in RBI. I haven't looked at stolen bases, where he was there, but he's high on that list too. He's seventh in stolen bases. Like in totality, his offensive numbers, when you compare it to a generation, are absolutely there. They're absolutely there. He's in the top, I'm looking at it right now, at least top 20, whatever it is, of WAR for second baseman. He played a lot fewer games. He had a lot of injury issues. So when you look at it that way, like when you look back at the history of baseball, how many years has baseball been around, right? I don't even
150-ish. 100,
so in 100 and so in 160 years, how many at each position do you think we should have? Of all the players that have played over 160 years of baseball, about how many do you think we should be at each position?
That's a really good question. I've never thought about before. Gosh, at each position over 150 years, probably 70, 75 at each position.
So when you think about it, there is no question if you go back and look at the numbers that Ian Kinsler has been a top 20 second baseman offensively, and he was a good defender all time. So by just about any metric, by war, by whatever offensive stat you want to pull, but he played around a lot of good second basemen, right? And so what's our criteria then? Because even if you wanted to call it top 30 or top 40 or whatever it is, even though the numbers would say he's much higher than that, that's where, and a guy like Chase Utley, guess what? Chase Utley's even higher, right? How long did it take us to put Jeff Kent in? And he should have been it. Jeff Kent is basically got the exact same career WAR that Ian Kinsler has. And let me see how many more games he played. He played about 200 more games. And that's a part of it. Look, I get it. That's, you know, stamina and all that's part of it. But what I mean is, and it's not just Kinsler, it's Andrew Jones. It's whoever you want to pull. Like if you went and you took where a guy stacks up all time in 160 years of baseball, you just have to think like, well, how many of these guys should we be celebrating? If you want it more exclusive than that, that's okay. We won't agree on that. But if you're going to open that up, you need to do it for each position to me. And we need to be looking at who the best players at their positions of every, because that's what we do in the other ones, right? That's what we do in football. That's what we do in basketball, I think, is a little different because it's all kind of combined with college and all the things that it is. But the Pro Football Hall of Fame, like they just try to celebrate who the best players were, right? Who the most impactful players were. And I think they do a good job of it in football. And then they just kind of cap it at how many you can get in. And that's why players have to wait. They don't have to wait because a writer one year says, yeah, you're a Hall of Famer. And then the next year, or one year says, nope, sorry, not good enough. But then the next year, when you haven't done anything, says, okay, now you're good enough. Like, that's so stupid.
I don't think I'm ready to debate you about Ian Kinsler's candidacy for the Hall of Fame. So I'll let you have that.
That wasn't my intent. You can go down the list and your guy, Andrew Jones, you can do the same thing with him, right? Like, where did he rank at his position? And why is he not in yet? But not that Ian Kinsler needs to be in yet or doesn't need to be in. Just saying, like, nobody's going to vote for that guy. We'll be right back.
It's time to get back to the sports talk.
All right, let's do this thing. Go!
Sports Daily is on KFH.
All right, welcome back in, everybody. Sports Daily, you want to win some HTO? You can do that right now by texting the keyword T to the short code 20357. That's T-E-A to the short code 20357. That'll get you a free iced tea and a free iStore hot coffee drink from HTO in East or West Wichita or in Derby. Good luck, everybody. You can enter once per day. Message and data rates apply. So now you got me in a rabbit hole here, Tommy. You got me in a rabbit
here
hole.
Here we go.
We're talking Hall of Fame. I'm just looking at this because I think this is an interesting way to do it, like career WAR. Because again, like it's really, really difficult to compare impact and stats, and did you play for a good team? Did you play for a bad team? RBI opportunities, right? Win opportunities as a pitcher, save opportunity. Like, all those things are really difficult. So it's not quite the same as some other sports where it's a little more black and white. I'm looking at center field all-time WAR ranking. We mentioned, and by accident, quite frankly, because I'm not sure I would say Ian Kinsler's a Hall of Famer, but just looking at his resume as an example, he's inside the top 20 all-time in WAR. We've been playing for 160 years. Should we have the 20 best second baseman in? I think that's, but you go to center field, guess where Carlos Beltran, guess who he's right behind? Joe DiMaggio. Okay. So like that guy needs to be in. Like, we shouldn't be waiting this long for a guy like Carlos Beltran, who is like head and shoulders above other Hall of Famers. Your guy, Andrew Jones, a little further down, but not much, right? He's not much further down. He's in this inside the top 10. Dude needs to be a Hall of Famer. You go to the shortstop conversation and you're going to find guys down like Jimmy Rollins, kind of in that range where Ian Kinsler is. Omar Vizquel, a guy who I think I'd like to see in just a handful of spots below that, but probably inside the top 30 or so. Pitchers is where it gets really hard. I'm looking at the pitcher list and there aren't, other than like our very, very, very top tier platinum members, whatever you want to do, it's mostly older players. Right, so that one's going to get a little bit challenging. Zach Greinke, of the guys not in now currently, that has nothing, you know, hanging over his head, I believe.
I think Cole Hamels will be somebody that I think the voters will probably take a look at from a pitching perspective.
Yeah, and he's further down that, you know, Burley, I believe, is ahead of Hamels. Felix Hernandez. Burley's actually, I think, ahead of Felix Hernandez. Burley's case is pretty good. I mean, he played for a lot of really bad
teams. I think the fact that CC Sabathia got in on his first ballot, that probably bodes well for starting pitchers in the future.
Because then you're
years.
Looking at left-handed pitchers, right? And now if you just took it to left-handed pitchers, then Burley goes way up the list. So it's an interesting topic. And I think for me, I don't want to hold people hostage. I don't like that aspect of it. But B, like, What is our criteria and how do we keep it consistent? How do we ensure that these best players are being recognized? Because if we're trying to, you know, stack, I don't know, Jimmy Rollins' case up against Honus Wagner, like that's not going to work, right? Like it doesn't, you can't do that.
Talking about Troy Tulowitzki compared to Rogers Hornsby is going to be
right.
That's a difficult comparison to make.
So how do we do that? How do we take, and those are two fringe guys. I think Rollins' case is probably a little better than Tulo's, but how do you take that and find where you fit in among your generation, I think is the best way to do it.
One thing that I think is really interesting, I'm a big time fan of Buster Olney from ESPN, longtime baseball writer, columnist for ESPN. I've always been a big fan of his. And he was writing about the induction this year for these guys and talking about the guys that didn't get in. And he brings up a pretty interesting double standard that I hadn't thought about before. So Kennesaw Mountain Landis, who longtime commissioner in Major League Baseball back, 100 years ago, I think he was the guy that was in charge during the whole Black Sox scandal, 8 men out, like all of that back in, when was that, 1920?
20s.
His name was on... I think, wasn't it the MVP or it was on, his name was on an award. Like it was the Kennesaw Mountain Landis Award. Well, his name was removed from that award a few years ago because there had been so many documented instances of like blatant racism that he had over the course of his tenure as commissioner, you know, trying to keep baseball segregated and, you know, all the different things before Jackie Robinson came around. So in current day, his name was removed from that award and because of everything that had happened. Well, it's an interesting double standard because we're still applying, like there was he had a big character clause when he was the commissioner. Like if players didn't abide by a certain kind of character, you know, then they weren't allowed to play in the game. They weren't allowed to be honored and bestowed upon and all of these different things. Well, his name was removed from the award, and we're still holding back players from the steroid era. We're holding back like Carlos Beltran with the whole sign-stealing scandal. If we're willing to remove a guy that was so exclusive for Major League Baseball And, you know, and in retrospect, like, his tenure was bad for a number of reasons, and he was a bad guy, and, like, all of this stuff. But we're willing to, like, remove him, and, like, his argument is it's past time for guys from the steroid era and guys like Carlos Beltran trying to get into the Hall of Fame.
Well, it is, because you don't want to – the disservice comes to the fans when you do that, right? Like, the disservice is to the people who love your sport the most. Only the people that love the sport the most are interested in this. Like, right now, we're talking about it because we both love baseball. There's probably a lot of people that are like, yo, time to get to Chiefs Bills right now.
Yeah.
And probably we should. But we love baseball, and so I don't want to see anything that – holds people away from the game or spoils the experience that they've had that have made them that sort of baseball fan. This is a museum to celebrate the game, or to at least tell the history.
To acknowledge the game, I think. And
tell the history of it. Like, could you imagine 3 generations from now ignoring and pretending like the steroid era didn't happen? Say what you want about it, but it saved the game in a lot of ways. It is as compelling a, you know, I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm just saying it's as compelling a piece of the history of the sport as there is. Like, you must preserve the ability to tell that chapter of the history of the game. That's what a museum's for. So that's for me, and I'm with Buster Olney.
Yeah.
Like, that's where it's real easy. Maybe you put these guys in the Hall of Fame, but you don't let them come to the ceremony or give a speech or whatever, but they're still there.
I think you just acknowledge it. Like, I think that in, you know, the bio of that person, like, you know, this is the wing of the museum where it you know, at least educates people on this era of baseball. And here's the thing. I know that there are ways after somebody drops off the ballot for them to still make the Hall of Fame. There's that eras committee where, you know, they're going to meet and they're going to, you know, throw in people from the past. Right. Manny Ramirez is probably going to have to go through that committee to get into the Hall of Fame because he's nowhere near the criteria to get voted in. And I think next year is his final year on the actual ballot. Anybody want to tell me Manny Ramirez is not a Hall of Famer?
Right.
Like, he 1,000% is a Hall of Famer. And I don't think that, you know, I think that there's this, like, I feel like these writers feel this, like, duty to preserve the integrity and to not celebrate these. I'm not even talking about celebrating Manny Ramirez. I'm talking about acknowledging, just from a baseline statistical point of view, regardless of what happened, that he deserves to be in the Hall of Fame just solely based on his numbers.
And he's one of the great characters of a generation. Like, you know. And
at least Alex Rodriguez still has time. Like, I think he's in year 3 or 4. Like, Ramirez, well, if he doesn't get in next year, he's got to rely on this committee to induct
him. And A-Rod has remained a part of the game through broadcasting and through ownership and some of the other things that he's done. So there's that discussion. If you want to leave us a message on it, you can. You can do that through the Odyssey app. We appreciate all the people that listen to us through the Odyssey app. That's probably a good way to continue that conversation. We'll put a pin in it for today. Let's turn the page and make a real hard right turn, Tommy. We're going to dig into KU in our next hour with Shreyaslata. Let's talk K-State real quick. Their game tonight, they get Baylor. Baylor's not as good as probably we thought they'd be, but still good, right? Still a good team, still a tournament team. They're kind of right on that fringe right now of Big 12 teams, but the metrics love Baylor still. So K-State's got to go down there. I do think, and I get the sense that there was something in the KU loss where everybody sort of felt like, where has that energy been? Like, maybe they found something within that game and maybe they can pull that forward. I don't know how many wins or losses that means. But man, like, no more nothing burgers, right? No, none of those. Get out there and play the way that you're capable. Like, that's it. We all know they're capable of it because these are all guys who have come in that have literally done it somewhere else.
Look, I had this thought when I was watching the Sunflower Showdown on Saturday that Kansas State is not a very good basketball team. Like, just from the X's and O's, they're not a very good basketball team, but they showed fight. They showed fight in that game against Kansas. They were down, 14-0 to start the game before they finally made a bucket. against the Jayhawks, all the momentum was swinging towards Kansas early on, and it would have been really, really easy for Jerome Tang's squad to just pack it up and say, look, we're outmatched, we don't have the talent, we can't play with these guys, this season is not going well, like, let's just get back to Manhattan. And they fought the entire game. They cut it to within six a couple of different times. Coleman Hawkins maybe had his best game as a Wildcat in Lawrence. I thought that they showed the fight to be able to keep this season going, even though it's been really disappointing. They may not be the best team in the Big 12. They're actually certainly not the best team in the Big 12. From a talent perspective, they might be the worst team. They're not a very good team. But at least they showed the fight and the heart to stay competitive against their in-state rival.
And I do think there's a discussion to be had, and we can have some of that with Trace Lotta, whether that had more to do with K-State or more to do with KU, that comeback. I think it's a fair and healthy discussion to have as we talk about, you know, the prospects and the trajectories of these two teams. But you at least, because we've talked to Tim Fitzgerald, I don't think there are changes coming to the program. They can't afford it, not in the current model. So there is still plenty on the line, I think, this year to sort of refocus on what the future can look like. Let's, you know, what young players can step into meaningful roles. Can Jerome Tang prove that he can run a better offense? We'll just put it right out there. Run a better offense than he's been able to do the last 2 years. Can he prove that this locker room will still play hard for him? You know, those things matter moving forward. So while it's kind of just wait for the Big 12 tournament and potential magic there as far as the postseason is concerned for K-State, I do think there is still plenty to dig into. And I got to tell you, like, if Coleman Hawkins all of a sudden, and that's the thing, like, his numbers are his numbers. Like, they've never really changed. But if he can change the perception of what he's been there, that would be a pretty crazy thing to watch. And I would love to be able to turn on K-State every night when they go and they play one of these top teams and really wonder if they have a shot to knock them off. And I think that's what we got a chance to get back to. And I think of Baylor that way. So tonight for K-State, in a game you'll hear, by the way, right here on KFH, pregame coverage begins at 7 o'clock for an 8 o'clock tip. Maybe they can go down to Waco and play spoiler. Jerome Tang's had a good career record against his former boss. That, I think, does give you some indication. Because if you can recapture that, now you've got some postseason, like Big 12 tournament, people get excited about it. It's all we want is to be excited about the teams we watch. When we come back, who's not excited about the Chiefs? We'll have the Chiefs-Bills discussion in the next hour, along with a KU preview with Shreyas Lotta. Don't go away.
Now, from Wichita's most listened to sports radio, 97.5 and 1240 KFH, this is Sports Daily with Jacob Albrecht and Tommy Kester.
All right, welcome back in, everybody. If you're on your way into work, want to keep listening to Sports Daily even after you park the car, with the Odyssey app and Odyssey.com, you can. Just download the app, visit Odyssey.com, search for KFH. Download it to get started. You'll also hear K-State there tonight, by the way, if you can't listen over the air. We appreciate everybody who downloads the show, listens to us in podcast form, everybody that leaves voice messages on the app for us. You can also leave us your comments on our video streams, Facebook, YouTube, X. And thanks for watching us as well on 12 News Connected. Tommy, Chiefs Bills, round two. Here we go again with these two teams who play each other all the time. I'm going to be honest. I'm having a really difficult time handicapping how I think this game will go. I felt like I had a real good grasp of the last one, and I think it was a pretty good representation of what happened in that game against the Texans. I really don't have one in this game. I'm having a hard time with it. Like, honestly, my gut says No hero ball from Josh Allen if you're the Chiefs. Like, if you can stop that, you'll win the game. If you don't let him do what he did in the first round on that big fourth down play and things like that, like, if he doesn't get the hero ball stuff, which he's very capable of doing, or if you can limit it at least, that's the ticket to the win for the Chiefs.
I think a big part of it was that the Chiefs should be really encouraged by what they saw from their pass rush against the Texans. And if they can even just get a fraction of that and that kind of pressure onto Josh Allen, then, you know, they could make it a little bit of a longer day offensively for the Bills. Now, Josh Allen and CJ Stroud are two totally different quarterbacks. And, you know, Josh Allen has shown over the course of his career that he can usually get away from the pass rush, you know, at a pretty good clip. And so it's going to be a larger challenge for the pass rush for Kansas City. But that was an element of their defense that we really hadn't seen come along quite at that level until last week.
I do think there's one thing to point out with that, and I think this is probably not getting enough run. CJ Stroud hurt his knee in that game, and it's almost like the Chiefs took advantage of that, right? They knew that, and you know, maybe that wasn't the only reason they got really, really aggressive late, but I do think they smelled blood in the water.
They did.
A little
bit. I think
they did. With Stroud's ability to avoid a pass rush, and so they came even harder. I don't think they can do that to Josh Allen.
I'm not suggesting that they can do that to Josh Allen. What I'm saying is that they hadn't shown that they could do it at that level up until a week ago. And that should be a motivating factor that, hey, like, we can do this. Like, it encourages us to maybe do it a little bit more. Now, can they get to Josh Allen like CJ Stroud? Probably not. But I do think that it at least should encourage what that unit can do.
And so, like, what they did against the Texans is encouraging and all of these things. I think with the Bills, though, it's probably going to look a lot different. I don't think they can play offense the same way. I don't think they can play defense the same way. I don't. And the good news is for Chiefs fans, I also think they're capable of playing about 100 different ways. And that's what their strength is, right? They can quickly adapt on the fly. But I don't imagine... Well, it's hard because you could say the Texans' game plan was effective. We talked about it yesterday. Yes, they let Travis Kelce eat, and Travis Kelce had the one big play that really inflated his numbers. They would have been good either way, but in totality, Tommy, the Texans' defense did a nice job limiting the Chiefs' offense. I mean, they did. So if you're Buffalo, do you see that and you say, let's do that again because we think we can score more than the Texans did in that game? Right, we don't think in the fourth quarter that Josh Allen's going to be swallowed up by a pass rush the way CJ Stroud was. So if you're Buffalo, do you look at it the same way and say, maybe we do let Kelce and not the receivers beat us because it's just whatever. We saw that be effective for the Texans. Or do you say, well, we're definitely not going to let Kelce do that to us.
But look,
I think you open yourself up to the best version of the Chiefs offense, which we saw toward the end of the regular season.
I think Dan Israel mentioned this yesterday. I think that it's a little bit misleading as far as like the total number of yards that the Chiefs had because of the fact that they were working on short fields a lot. Just because of some of the miscues that the Texans had. And I do think that that's important to look at. I don't think that the Texans did this bang up job of limiting Kansas City offensively. I think that obviously Travis Kelce had a big game, but then number two, Kansas City also showed that they can get it done in the red zone. And that was another challenge that I know that Kansas City struggled with throughout the regular season. So when it mattered the most for the Texans defensively, they weren't able to stop the Chiefs offense. They weren't able to stop them on third down. They went to Travis Kelce a lot. That's been a big formula and recipe for the last decade for the Chiefs. You go find Travis Kelce when you need a conversion. And then number two, the Chiefs were able to get the ball into the end zone in the red zone. And that's, again, a challenge. That's something that they haven't been able to do quite at the level they've wanted to. So I think that there's this misconception that the Texans locked down the Chiefs defensively,
I don't think they locked them down. But I think they did an objectively good job.
They did a good job on the wide receivers.
Let me go down this road, and I don't want you to take this the wrong way. So I'm telling you right now, don't take this the wrong way at all.
Okay.
But think about this too. Okay, I'm just looking here back at the drive charts after the first roughing the passing penalty, right? Which would have been a drive-ending incompletion. That penalty didn't really have anything to do with the outcome of the play that would have made it fourth down. the Chiefs went on to gain another like 45 yards on that drive. Okay. So that's where, you know, that's where you're frustrated, I think, if you're a Texans fan. Let me find the other one here. And again, I think the other one was far more, you know, was a penalty. They gained and continue to drive that way too. So that's where I think like you're seeing some of the Texans' frustrations is they do feel like they had him off the field there. So only in the context of like total yardage is the only reason I bring that up. So in the context of total yardage, like if you end those, let's just call them, let's just say they're penalties and we'll call them penalties because they were penalties and that's fine. But without those mistakes, then the Texans defense limits that Chiefs offense even more. So when we're talking about game planning, if you're Buffalo, I do think there's something to take away from that coming from their perspective. Like, you know what? If the Texans don't have those two bad penalties, whether you think they were penalties or not, like if they didn't commit them, they really like they had two of those drives and one of them, the first one led to points, right? And so then you look at it if you're Buffalo and be like, that's a pretty good, that was a pretty good game plan in totality of the way they were able to do that. Now, I would also tell you that I think there was rust involved in that early on for the Chiefs offense too. I just, if we're trying to look at the X's, which is what we're doing today, right? We're just trying to look at the X's and O's of this. I'm not so sure that if I'm Buffalo, I don't take away some style ideas and things that they did in the way that I'm going to approach the game. There's the counter, of course, of, well, Patrick Mahomes is going to react to that now because he just saw it too. So that's where you get into the difficulties of game planning against Mahomes anytime. But I don't think Houston had a bad game plan. They didn't let the Chiefs run all over them. They gave up some to Kelsey. Kelsey had the one big 50-yarder. And then otherwise, you're looking at, you know, six catches, 50 yards. I think you live with that if you're Houston. He got one and he broke one off. He's a Hall of Famer, maybe the best that's ever done it. But I don't think that makes it a bad game plan necessarily.
I don't think they had a bad game plan by any means. I just don't think that, you know, they did this remarkable job of locking down Kansas City offensively. And I think that you know, that's something that I'm not sure that anybody with the Chiefs looks at it from what happened against the Texans and thinks, man, like we've got to, you know, change what we're doing big time as we play the Bills. I think the Bills are a completely separate beast. They've got, you know, different qualities and attributes and advantages that the Texans didn't have and vice versa. Dan Israel, again, yesterday talked about Matt Milano and how, you know, he's a difference maker. And he definitely has been. It's different. He plays a different kind of game than the great pass rush that the Texans have with Will Anderson and Danielle Hunter. So that you've got a game plan a little bit differently for the personnel sure. that this team has. I'm not sure, though, that you come away, again, from that Texans game thinking, all right, we got to do something different against the Bills, at least offensively. I think they've
I'm
got
talking
enough.
About the other way.
They've got
I'm
enough
about what the Bills
right.
are doing.
I think they've got enough weapons to where, again, like if you bracket Travis Kelce, if the Bills are like, we can't let Travis Kelce beat us in the way that he beat the Texans, if you bracket Travis Kelce, well, then the Chiefs are going to, it's a chess match. You've got DeAndre Hopkins and Hollywood Brown, yes. Xavier Worthy. I do think, I told you this during the game on Saturday, you and I were texting back and forth. I think my personal opinion is that Kareem Hunt should be running back one. I think he should be the lead back. Moving forward, it doesn't mean that you can't use Pacheco, but I think that what Kareem Hunt can do and his skill set, especially against the Bills, I think you need to lean on him early more than you need to lean on Isaiah Pacheco. That's just my opinion in the matter. So I do think that there are some tweaks that they should at least consider doing leading up to what Buffalo's defense can throw at you.
Yeah, let's get into it because I have a better idea of like the Chiefs and what I think they should do offensively. This one was more about, you know, how does it match up on the Bills side of it? Like if I'm Sean McDermott, what am I looking at from that game? Yeah. Let's get into the Chiefs then on the other side. Andy Reid talked about that. The defensive side, the last time these two teams played, the Chiefs defense had its worst game of the yeah. season. So there's that. What can the Chiefs do in offense? We'll have it all. We have Shreya Slada helping us preview the KU game later in the hour as well. Stick with us. Sports Daily coming right back.
The commercials are over.
Yo, I haven't got all day.
869-1240.
Time to get busy.
This is Sports Daily on KFH.
Welcome back, everybody. It is Sports Daily. We are glad to be here with you on this Wednesday. Jacob Albrock, Tommy Caster, Shreya Slotta coming up next segment to help us get ready for KU-TCU tonight. Glad to be here with you. We're talking Chiefs-Bills this hour, so let's get into it. So that beginning there was sort of, what do the Bills take away? If you're the Bills, what do you take away from the game that you saw Houston play against Kansas City? Tom and I disagree a little bit. I actually think Houston did a pretty good job defensively against Kansas City, strategically. I think their offense didn't put them in good positions, and I think a couple of key penalties really inflated what the Chiefs were able to do to them. So if you're the Bills now, you look at it and you say, whatever they say to do, what should the Chiefs' offensive game plan? I can tell you that Andy Reid said yesterday one of the keys for the Chiefs defensively is third down defense, which if we remember parts of the Buffalo game, that was the Superman stuff I talked about from Josh Allen extending drives. Like he put on his cape for that
game. It's been a challenge all season for Kansas City. They have a hard time getting off the field defensively on third down.
And so Josh Allen had a big game. He, of course, had that big fourth down play for the put away touchdown and all those things. So when we go back, though, and we talk about the Chiefs offense here, and we'll talk about that first. What is the game plan? We did talk a lot about this. We'll start with a point that you brought up in the last segment that Kareem Hunt should be the lead guy. It's not, I don't care which one of them. Let me start over. I love the hot hand approach for a team like the Chiefs right now, when Isaiah Pacheco, you know, still coming back from injury and all those things. I will say this, though. I do prefer, if Kareem Hunt ends up with more carries, totally good with it, doesn't bother me. I do, though, prefer to start the game with Pacheco because of his propensity to break off the chunk plays. The one thing Kareem Hunt can't do anymore is that. Like, he doesn't have chunk plays really in him anymore other than 10 yards. Now, of course, he could do that and whatever. But for the most part, we haven't seen that from him. Pacheco, we know, has that in the tank and could break one off at any point. And so, like, if you're going to give Hunt more carries, which I am totally on board with, I would rather see that late in the game, your closer, sort of in the rotation like they did it last time, because I would love for the Chiefs to, and I don't want to call it a cheap one, but I think you know what I mean, get a cheap one early. Where the blocking is perfect and Pacheco can break one off and get you a quick touchdown when you weren't expecting it.
Yeah, I disagree. I mean, I think that you need to start with Kareem Hunt because you need to establish a rhythm offensively. And Isaiah Pacheco early on in the game had a really difficult time against Houston getting positive yardage to a point to where it would extend drives for Kansas City early in the downs, like first down, second down, like early in the game. There wasn't a whole lot there for him. When Kareem Hunt came in later in the game, he was able to, I think, have a little bit more momentum in that regard. But it's going to be crucial for Kansas City to establish drives early in the game because you mentioned the rust factor. I think that was some of it. Like, they had drives stalling out in part, not totally because of Isaiah Pacheco, but in part because Pacheco had a hard time getting it going on early down situations. So I feel like if you give it to Kareem Hunt and he can get you 4 or 5 yards on first down, as opposed to like last week with Isaiah Pacheco getting you one or none on first down, then that's going to allow you to get into a little bit more of a rhythm. And I think Kareem Hunt's got a better chance of doing that in this game against Buffalo than Pacheco does early on. It doesn't mean that I don't think Pacheco should see the field. I definitely think he should because, as you mentioned, he has the propensity and the ability to break one off. But I would rather early on in the game see the Chiefs be able to establish drives, keep the momentum going, and not, you know, potentially have a 3-and-out situation or get a first down, but then, you know, be behind the sticks because you have a loss on a first down run from Pacheco.
Yeah, and I think Houston deserves some credit for that. And honestly, if sure, you flip-flopped it and you let Pacheco do that against a more battered defense, we see Saquon Barkley break him off and Derrick Henry in the second half. So I'm good with it either way. I think the point is use them both. And that we agree on. I think you have to look back. We're talking about Buffalo looking back to what Houston did. If you're Kansas City, you got to look back at what Baltimore did. And Baltimore ran the ball very effectively, especially late in that game, like very effectively. And so I think you take something away from that. Here's the big difference, though, from the last time we saw the Chiefs play the Bills, is the Chiefs passing game now is years better than what it was the first time they played. And I do think, and this is where when I say I have a really hard time like pegging what exactly what I think will happen in the game, because now it's Josh Allen on the other side. We know historically how some of these games have gone. I do think and won't have a problem with the Chiefs trying to be a little more high octane on offense either. I'd love for them to play ball control offense, run the ball, and keep Josh Allen off the field. I just don't know if they're going to be able to do that. So as effective late in the year as that passing game has been, I also don't mind if they sit there and say, you know what, we're going to try and shred them that way. It's not the best pass rush. It's not a bad pass rush. It's just not like what the Texans is to me. And so if you want to throw it more than you might in another game, I honestly think I'm okay with it, because now they have their full complement of receivers. Now you have a more competent left tackle situation than you did. And there's just such a good chance that you're going to have to, at some point, these two quarterbacks put their capes on and this becomes a little bit of a track meet. I don't know if it is for the whole game, but for a portion of the game, it feels like it might be, and you got to be able to keep up. So, like, my gut says kind of a worthy game, probably. Not as much of a Kelce game, probably a little more of a worthy game. I don't know what to make of DeAndre Hopkins' role right now. I would bet you that the Chiefs take, let's call it, at least three shots over the top in this game, if not more, because you got to try and get some, and again, I keep calling them cheap ones, but you know what I mean. You got to keep trying to catch them on their heels a little bit and score some points that way, because I think if you can get a lead in this game, you're in good shape. I don't think you want to play this team coming from behind, because I'll bet you this. I'll bet you Buffalo tries to run the ball. I'll bet you Buffalo tries to run the ball.
Okay, so when you combine the regular season and postseason, the Bills have played 19 games this year. You know how many of those games they've scored 30-plus points? 13 of the 19 games they've scored 30-plus points, including games where they've scored 48, 42. How many times have the Chiefs scored 30 points this season? Zero. Zero times. So, you know, that going back to that whole, like, you might need to be a track meet, I think that's a bad outcome for the Chiefs. I don't think that they don't want to play that game. So, I mean, I think that as far as like taking shots downfield and things like that, if you time it right and you know, you pick your spots to do that, if you're Kansas City, okay. But I think the ball control piece of it, you're way underselling the importance. I think Kansas City ball control in this game.
The importance is top of the list. I'm just saying I don't know that they'll be able to do it exclusively through the run game. And so what we saw late in the year, why featuring Worthy that way and featuring these receivers, that's what I'm talking about. I think we may see them attack the Bills the way they attack teams late in the year versus what they, you know, I do think they should take a few shots in this game, because I do think that's a good way to keep. But I would, what I'm saying is it a 28 running back carry kind of game? I doubt it, but the ball control can come in the way that they did that late in the year against the Texans, not the playoff game, but the game before, and the Steelers and some of those games where they just picked you apart and had long, sustained drives. It's a lot of what they did last year, right? That's kind of what they did with Rashee Rice last year. Now they've got kind of three guys between D-Hop and Worthy and Kelce. All of them can do that. And I think they're going to feature that. So I don't know if they're going to give the running backs the ball 25 times. In fact, I don't think they will. I think they'll attack it through the short passing game. And what I'm saying is I'm okay with that now.
Yeah, I think that's fine.
Didn't used to be. The last time they played out, I said that's insane. Now, though, with Tooney at left tackle, with all the receivers and the weapons there, I think that's probably the way they're going to attack the Bills is through a short pass.
And I don't care if it's, you know, success through the running game or if it's success through the short and intermediate passes. If you have success in either one of those phases, then that should allow you to be able to take some shots. If they're well-timed, if they're in the moment of the game plan or whatever that is, I get it. I don't think if we see a scenario where the Chiefs offensively feel like they have to start forcing shots, and that goes back to your point where if they're playing from behind, they're toast in that regard. That's not the way Kansas City wants to play.
You're not going to keep Allen off the field.
Yeah.
Like if you give Allen a chance to have it be in the driver's seat, like he's the ultimate third down quarterback. And I don't know what the numbers roll out this year, but when you're a quarterback like him and you can run the way he can, it's the ultimate. Mahomes does the same thing, right? Mahomes in the postseason on third downs runs for first downs. Like Mahomes rushing yards is such a great prop in the postseason because you know he's going to take off to get first downs. And Josh Allen does the same thing. And so, yeah, if you get behind and Allen knows you're behind, he is going to do everything in his power to not let you have chances to catch up. And that's what makes him. That's how they beat the Ravens, right? Hey, Ravens, you're going to make a couple of mistakes. We'll get a lead. Watch us not do anything on offense, but hold the ball and not let you be on offense anymore. And they are totally capable of doing that.
That's where James Cook comes in.
Cook is underrated, but it's James Cook and Josh Allen unleashed, right? There's no more holding anything back. And so now with both of those guys, is it Hurts and Barkley? No. Is it Lamar and Derrick Henry? No. But it's really good with Josh Allen and James Cook, like really good. And it makes their red zone offense really lethal because those two guys score tons of touchdowns. So if you're the Chiefs, you got to be efficient. We all know it's the most obvious statement in the world to say neither one of these teams can afford turnovers. Look at what happened last week in all of the divisional games. I doubt that unless it's spectacular defensive plays, right? Like a blindside strip sack. I doubt we see very many turnovers in this game. If you gave me an over-under, I'd say two or fewer total turnovers in this game. It'll take great defensive plays. I don't think these quarterbacks are going to make mistakes. I don't think they're going to allow themselves to make mistakes. They both know what it takes to win this game. And that's the one thing you absolutely cannot do is turn the ball over.
I think also Amari Cooper is probably the best decoy in the NFL, the way that he fits into this Bills offense. Because it's not like he's, you know, being featured, right? It's not like he's getting, you know, a bunch of catches and yardage and things like that. But even just his, you know, mere presence on the field, I think attracts a lot of attention. And it's allowed guys like Khalil Shakir, who is really underrated, I think, league, to feast big time. Keon Coleman's been up and down. I know, obviously, you know, he's still growing into his role in the NFL. But the tight end play, that's been an area that the Chiefs have struggled with all year. And the Bills have two great ones. And so it's going to be, I think, a major test, obviously, again, for Trent McDuffie, for Jalen Watson. Hopefully, you know, they can continue to increase Watson's, time on the field and all of that. But it's going to be a test of the secondary for sure. And especially on third downs, number one, but then also doing what you can to try to limit what Dawson Knox and Dalton Kincaid can do.
Yeah, both of these, and it starts with the quarterbacks. They're so capable of doing so many different things well. Everyone I talk to, they're like, man, this is going to be a really great game. And it's like, yeah, like there's almost no chance it's not, because what we knew going into the Houston game, we had a real good idea of what was going to happen. Like Kelsey's going to go off, right? Like you could see it coming a mile away. Kelsey's going off in this game. Houston's seen what's happened. They're going to have to stop these receivers. Kelsey's going to feast. Buffalo, whether they let that same thing happen, that's I don't know. Like I'm not saying he won't. It may be another big Kelsey game, and Buffalo may be totally fine with that. I'm not sure yet I don't think I'm going to have a good take on that. This will be a hard game to handicap if you're looking at props, if you're looking at any of it, because both of these teams are versatile. They have shown throughout the course of this season they can win in different ways. They did it last week. Look at the lines. Like, look at the way Buffalo won that game. Weather played a factor, but you'd have never guessed that in a million years when we went into that game that Buffalo would win if Josh Allen threw for 127 yards and only ran for 20 yards. Josh Allen only had 147 combined yards in that game. We go into that and I tell you that, you'd be like, oh, the Ravens are going to smash them. It's not what happened. They're capable of doing that. And to your point, they score 30 points more often than they don't.
Yeah.
They're also capable of track meeting
you. Yeah, they can do it in a couple different ways. And it goes back
Kansas
to what
City's
you...
Kansas City's the same way.
It goes back to what you had mentioned before that, you know, every team is going to be this way, but really Buffalo knows how to take advantage of turnovers. They're going to let you make a mistake, and then they're going to put their foot on your throat. And the Ravens turned the ball over. Lamar threw a pick, put the ball on the turf. Mark Andrews put the ball on the turf. Like, those sort of things, you are not going to be able to survive when you're playing a team like Buffalo. The good news for Kansas City going into this game, they've not turned the ball over in 2 months. Right. They have cut down on that. They know, at least in the last 2 months, the last seven games they played, since the last time they played Buffalo in Buffalo, how to take care of the football. That's been a really nice development for the Chiefs in the last couple of months. And honestly, they wouldn't be in this position if they had been playing the way that they played and still turning the ball over. And the fact that they were able to clean that part of it up, I think it is a huge factor going into this game. You mentioned, you know, how many, like the over under as far as total turnovers, and you said two or under. I think it might even be one or under, because Buffalo, well, I don't think going to turn the ball over, and I really don't think Kansas City will either.
But I think, and so I think there are enough playmakers on defense where you've got to be careful to that too. Like, there can be turnovers that weren't necessarily like a mistake that was made, but they're just an incredible defensive play, right? And I think both of these teams, like, I'll bet you at the top of their list this week and the things that they talk about, not turning the ball over is at the top of both of their lists. Like, it is a concerted effort. And what that means is maybe they don't take a chance on a play, especially early, that they don't have to, because they're going to ensure that they don't turn the ball over. Kansas City, from their perspective, they can afford to do that now because they're healthy. They couldn't afford to do that early in the year. Mahomes had to take chances. He didn't have anybody to throw it to. He had to take those chances. And it's not just on offense that they're healthy. Now you have more trust in your defense with Chris Jones fully healthy, with the pass rush finally being somewhat effective, and Jalen Watson's back. There's a trust factor there if you're Mahomes. Yep, don't need to throw that. We'll be fine. We got everybody back on defense. They'll come make a stop for us. The Chiefs haven't been able to say that all year. They haven't. They've been, you know, they for whatever reason, for a variety of reasons, they haven't been able to say that. They also have to be careful not to allow left tackle to cause a blindside strip sack. What does that mean? Probably means a quicker passing game, right? Means they're going to try. And that's great. That's fine. You better believe that Andy Reid and Sean McDermott, every single day this week, and Josh Allen and Patrick Mahomes are in there talking to everybody individually and saying, hey, just want to remind you, no mistakes this week. We're not turning the ball over. Don't make it easy on them, right? And because they're both smart enough to know we can't overcome that. Look at what happened last week. If you think we're so good that we can overcome that, I want you to look back at last week. Every team that turned the ball over more and outgained their opposition lost the game. Every single time, all four games, it's simple. We have to take care of the ball. And so then if you don't factor in turnovers, what do you factor in? That's where this game is so compelling. You've got the two best in the business at quarterback. And these kinds of spots, my goodness. This is going in. This is as good as any of them have been going in. Like, I don't think there's any doubt about that. I got nothing for you. It's tough to predict. We'll keep trying to do it all week. When we come back, though, we'll talk KU hoops. Sharia Slaughter, KU insider, joins to preview the game tonight. Next.
Oh, okay, take it easy. We're going on the air.
This is Sports Daily on KFH. And now, digging deeper with the teams you follow, it's another Sports Daily Insider interview on KFH.
And welcome back in. Sharia Slaughter joins us, KU beat writer for the KC Star, on this Wednesday morning ahead of a big game tonight between KU and TCU down in Fort Worth. KU is a 6.5-point favorite in this game. Vegas thinks this will be a defensive slugfest. Trius, good morning. How are you?
Good. How are you guys?
We're good. We're good. So where do we stand right now with KU? The big start against K-State, they get the win. It's been as dominant maybe as people thought in the beginning of the year. It comes off of an Iowa State loss earlier in the week on the road that was closer than the final score would indicate. How are the Jayhawks feeling going into this week? TCU and Houston at home are the two games.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty important week in a sense. You have to win a road game against an opponent that is going to be a defensive, I think, game for both sides because their strengths lie on defense. And obviously, winning at home against Houston is huge. Houston's a good team, and you want to come out there and win two in a row because I feel like we haven't seen Kansas win two in a row in a while. You know, it feels like we've been alternating between wins and losses for a little bit for the last few weeks. And obviously that's dependent on the opponents they've played. But kind of where I'm at with this team is elite defensive team has the opportunity to become a lot better than they are offensively. But right now I think they're like 45th, according to KenPom, in adjusted offensive efficiency. So it's just not a great offensive team compared to the last 2 years of what I've covered under Bill Self. They've been much better even then. So I think they can be better. I think it's going to be a big test without KJ Adams, the defensive end today. But really against Houston's going to be the bigger test. I'm encouraged by the defensive stuff. I'm encouraged by Flory's play. I'm encouraged by those things. I'm not sure what's going to happen with the offense. I think that's the big question mark I have. And I think that could be make or break them, I think, come March.
It was interesting, Sharius, because I felt like we saw in the Sunflower Showdown AJ Storr have an opportunity to maybe break out of his funk a little bit. You know, I think he shot the ball better than we've seen him shoot maybe his entire time in Lawrence. And I don't know if that's, you know, the beginning of better things for AJ Storr or if it was kind of a perfect storm, everything coming together with KJ Adams out. You know, really, he needed to be leaned on a little bit heavier. What was your takeaway on Storr's play, and what do you think we'll see from him moving forward?
Yeah, I thought it was encouraging. I think that was the best defensive effort he's had probably all season. Offensively, it looked like he was doing the right things for the most part. I think he struggled to guard Coleman Hawkins. That was a tough assignment for him. Regardless, I mentioned this to another beat reporter. I think it's hard to take away things from games like Kansas State is just not a good team this year. Let's call it what it is. And I think the same thing that's going to happen today is like, I don't think TCU is a very good team. I think offensively, they're just not good enough for me to sit there and say, I think they're going to challenge Kansas enough to make this a game. I think Kansas is a better all around team at both ends. And by both metrics, TCU's offense is pretty putrid. The defense is really good, but this is the issue. It's like hard. How many, like, I haven't seen them give me this feeling with whether it's AJ or any of these other transfers that they accepted, Zeke Mayo, where I think against the top end of the conference or in March that they can handle themselves. There hasn't been consistency on that end. And that's my question with this Kansas team is yes, they can beat the bad teams. They can beat the mediocre teams, the average teams. But can they consistently beat the top end teams or even be in the conversation to beat them? Because they really weren't in Iowa State. I know we talked about it being a little closer than it was, and it was close, but Iowa State led pretty much the entire way. There was always a 6-point lead minimum, you know, and KU kind of let go of the rope there. And you see that the spread was, I think, 6.5, and Kansas lost by like, what, 15, 20 almost?
17, I think.
Yeah. 17. Yeah. Yeah. So it's one of those things that, you know, I'm encouraged in some ways with this Kansas team, but it's really, really hard for me to sit there and say they are definitively the best team in the conference. I'm not even sure. Yeah. Yeah. You know, and I think that's the thing, right? When you were a Kansas fan, the expectation was this team was going to be the best team or at least competing for it. And they could be competing for a Big 12 title. They could. Right. But it starts by consistency game in, game out. And I haven't really seen that from Kansas in a few weeks. And you know, it starts by winning today against TCU and then beating Houston at home, which they should do.
They're not the best team now, but I think they still could be. And I think if all things align and you get, and I'm glad you guys brought up AJ Storr because we are seeing him gain a little confidence. Flory Badunga got his opportunity and he was good in it. 26 minutes, but four fouls again. Shreyas, like, you know, like what's Bill Self saying about his ability to stay on the floor? Because we all, like, anybody with eyes can see the upside of Flory Badunga and the things he can do for this team, but he has to be able to stay on the floor. And I don't remember the last game where he didn't have four fouls or three fouls or whatever it is. Like, he's still got to learn how to play college basketball. Where do you think that progress is for him among the coaches?
Yeah, you know, it's something Mills talked about where he wants him to stay longer, because then you have him extended period of time out. I think there was that run when K-State was making Flora was off the floor at that point. You know, it just makes it so much easier for Kansas to be one-dimensional without him on the floor, with no KJ Adams either. You know, the defense just kind of falls off a cliff. I think, you know, what Bill had mentioned is, you know, he's encouraged by his play. He was happy with how Flora played against K-State. But like you said, the foul thing is going to be a thing that we're going to continue to monitor, because right now, you know, 3-4 fouls, whatever, not a big deal. We're in January. But if this is still happening in March, it's a dangerous, dangerous situation. You know, it's one of those things that, you know, if he's getting 4 fouls in the 22 or 25 minutes a game or whatever he's going to play in March, it's going to be put KU in a stressful situation. And you know, analytically, Bill had mentioned this, and Evan Mia confirmed this, Kansas' best lineup right now includes Hunter Dickinson and Floyd Dunga. It, you know, it is a really good combination. You know, I think the absolute best is what I saw was DeJuan Harris, Zeke Mayo, Shaquille Moore, Hunter Dickinson, and Floyd Dunga, which is an interesting combination because the first three are pretty short, and then you have two really big guys.
A two-point guard and two-center lineup.
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody's running that.
Like, yeah, so it's like, obviously, you know, the combination of minutes hasn't been played that much, so that's probably why it's a little skewed. But, you know, I've been a very big Floyd Dunga guy in the sense of I think he is the most talented big KU's had in years. And his skill set is something they haven't had since, honestly, Embiid. I think that's the, you know, the level of talent that he has, he could have next year. I mean, think about it, guys. He hasn't been playing basketball that long. He started playing basketball 14, 15 years old. And this is just the precipice of, I think, what he can become. And he's going to be a guy that's going to be in the NBA for a long, long time.
Hunter Dickinson, 25 points, 8 rebounds, 12 of 19 shooting from the floor. And he's had so much criticism heaped on him, you know, throughout the course of this season. And we've talked about him on this show. Like, I think, Jacob, what was the word you used? You looked like a, you know, old man playing pickup basketball at the Y, you know,
he's
like
got the old man trot.
Yeah.
Yeah. That trot back down the floor the other way. Like that. I know that's stiff. That's like, I can't throw my back out on the way back down.
But I mean, look, I mean, the production was absolutely there against K-State, and, you know, he showed why he's almost an auto bucket, you know, for the Jayhawks. Are you seeing, I mean, obviously we're now midway through the season. Are you seeing signs that he's rounding back into that form that we wanted to see from him for so long, or has it always been there? We just haven't really been able to appreciate it.
I see the flashes, you know, but if we go back to the Iowa State game, Hunter Dickinson wasn't very good.
Yeah.
Right. He wasn't great. And I feel like this is this weird thing with Hunter this year. And I think I didn't notice this as much last year. It feels like there's halves he's just unnoticed. You know, where he has 4 points on 5 shots and he has 4 rebounds with it. And, you know, you just can't get that out of Hunter Dickinson and expect to win a lot of basketball games or be in basketball games. I think it was a very encouraging sign. He took over in the second half against Kansas State. I think he scored the first 10 buckets out of first 10 points out of the half for them. That's great. I also don't think Kansas State had anybody who could really guard him. You know, like, this is something I expect. I mean, maybe my expectations for Hunter Dickinson are very high, but this is a guy who's been here 5 years. He's old. He's probably going to play overseas or play in the G League or NBA or whatever next year. He's 7'1". My expectations for Hunter Dickinson is 20 and 12, like every game, minimum. Maybe that's a too high of an expectation for him, but that's the amount of shots he takes. That's the amount of usage he has. He's clearly the guy alongside Zeke Mayo to score the basketball for Kansas. That's the expectation. Maybe you don't need to get 20 and 12 every game, but it's kind of what an ideal version of Hunter Dickinson looks like. You know, he's not always going to be the best on defensive end, but you want to hope those numbers can come out. For me, what I need to see out of Hunter Dickinson is consistency. I think that's the same thing I haven't seen from this entire Kansas team is game in, game out consistency. I want to see that happen more often from him. I want to see that happen from half to half for him. But I also want to see that from the Kansas Jayhawks, because, guys, when's the last time they've won definitively against both of their opponents in a week? I can't remember. November was probably the last month that's happened.
Hunter Dick, I'm totally aligned with that Hunter Dickinson baseline, because the reality is if he's either getting that or they're making teams pay for trying to stop him for it, that's going to be the best version of Kansas, right?
Yeah.
I also think I'm with you on Flory Badunga. I think he unlocks Hunter Dickinson. I think he helps him on the defensive end, and I think he certainly creates more opportunities for him on the offensive end. And we'll see, because KJ Adams, we know as of Monday or so, Bill Self said, will miss 3 or 4 games. So they're going to get some time to tinker a little bit and then hopefully bring KJ Adams back with a force to be that defensive guy he is. What do you guys have for us, Shreyas, at the KC Star ahead of this game tonight?
Yeah, I have my TCU scouting breakdown preview, and obviously Gary will be there at Texas today. So I'm back in Lawrence because I'm helping out with Chiefs coverage this week, so that should be fun. I'll be there live tweeting, doing the usual. It should be a fun game. I think it'll be a defensive slugfest. I think this Kansas team is so good defensively. I think it's the best Kansas team I've seen in my 2.5 a year on a beat. So, yeah.
And there's upside, honestly, for the defense, which is good, too. We'll have Shreyas's coverage tonight. You can follow him on social on X at SHRE98. You can find his work at the KC Stars, a KU Insider. Shreyas, we appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's good stuff. I like 6.5 tonight, Tommy. I'll be honest. I don't know about the over-under, but I like 6.5.
I like it too. I'm a fan of it. I think it's an opportunity for, you know, Kansas, to Shreyas's point, be able to have a couple of back-to-back fairly convincing conference wins. And I think that sort of momentum can, you know, continue to push you into the weeks ahead as we get deeper and deeper into conference play.
And it's a game flow that you would anticipate Kansas is very comfortable in, because you can start with Hunter Dickinson and see where that takes you. You don't have to try to keep up with somebody like when you're playing Iowa State.
Yeah, and we didn't get a chance to talk to Shreyas about this. I think the only concern I have, obviously you don't have KJ Adams, that's going to be, you know, a concern. But the only other concern I have is that over the last couple of games, we've seen the minutes on the court and the production trending down from guys like Rylan Griffin and David Coit. Like, those two guys are not doing much. Rylan Griffin was scoreless in 12 minutes on the floor. And he's, you know, at one point he was, I think, the first guy off the bench. I know I think he maybe even started a couple of games for the Jayhawks. His production is trending downward. That's a little concerning for me. And so I want to see how the Jayhawks combat that.
You know, what sucks about that for Griffin is, but you're seeing the development of Store, and I think we all kind of see the same thing, right? Team's going to be better if it's Store that steps into that role. So we'll see how that develops. It would be, what would I think be great is if Griffin becomes an instant offense kind of guy.
For sure.
But they need Store to be better. We got more coming up on Sports Daily. Don't go anywhere. We're coming right back on the other side. It's a Wednesday. It's all Brockton Caster. Stick around.